Topic for this talk is Pancha Khanda Upadana. This is the five aggregates of clinging. It's a part of the fourth foundation of mindfulness. We've been talking about the four foundations of mindfulness for several weeks now. When I was in graduate school, mandatory to take a course, I got my master's degree in counseling, psychology. So it was mandatory course on personality theory. So the textbook was one that was commonly used around the country, apparently. But there was one chapter, it was written by a fellow named Daniel Goleman. It's a very well-respected author, but he also has been a mindfulness meditator for 50 years now. But the chapter in the book that he wrote was Five Aggregates as Personality Theory. And I was really psyched about that because that's what drew me into counseling anyways. I think that the Buddha was probably the first psychologist in human history. But my classmates weren't at all interested. But I think that this concept is a very important, very useful tool, process of liberation from distress and confusion. In fact, the first talk, supposedly by the Buddha, discourse on the first turning of the wheel for liberation. There's a quote from that. Noble truth of suffering, dukkha, monks, is this. Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, sickness is suffering, death is suffering, association with unpleasant is suffering, dissociation from the pleasant is suffering. Not to receive what one desires is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates subject to grasping are suffering. Different excerpt from a different sutra has some points a finger at how this theory of personality deconstructs the belief that there is an enduring autonomous self. Anatta concept, Buddhism. So I didn't quote the entire discourse, but here's the relevant terms. Friends, the Tathagata, the supreme man, the superlative man, attainer of the superlative attainment, being described, is described otherwise than with these four positions. The Tathagata exists after death, does not exist after death, both does and does not exist after death. Neither exists or does not exist after death. The Tathagata is a descriptive of the Buddha. Basically, the translation of Tathagata is thus gone. I like to think of it as one who has mastered suchness. One of the students of the Buddha, having heard this, went to him and asked him, is this true? It's the notion about the Tathagata. It was what the Buddha's response was, or the Tathagata's response. What do you think, Anuruddha? Is form constant or inconstant? Inconstant, Lord. And is that which is inconstant easeful or stressful? Stressful, Lord. And is it proper to regard what is inconstant, stressful, subject to change, as this is mine, this is myself, this is what I am? No, Lord. Is feeling constant or inconstant? Inconstant, Lord. Is perception constant or inconstant? Inconstant, Lord. Are fabrications constant or inconstant? Inconstant, Lord. Is consciousness constant or inconstant? Inconstant, Lord. And is that which is inconstant easeful or stressful? Stressful, Lord. And is it proper to regard what is inconstant, stressful, subject to change as, this is mine, this is myself, this is what I am? No, Lord. What do you think, Anuruddha? Do you regard form as the Tathagata? No, Lord. Do you regard feeling as the Tathagata? No, Lord. Do you regard perception as the Tathagata? No, Lord. Do you regard fabrications as the Tathagata? No, Lord. Do you regard consciousness as the Tathagata? No, Lord. What do you think, Anuruddha? Do you regard the Tathagata as being in form, elsewhere than form, in feeling, elsewhere than feeling, in perception, elsewhere than perception, in fabrications, elsewhere than fabrications, in consciousness, elsewhere than consciousness? No, Lord. What do you think? Do you regard the Tathagata as form, feeling, perception, fabrications, consciousness? No, Lord. Do you regard the Tathagata as that which is without form, without feeling, without perception, without fabrications, without consciousness? No, Lord. And so, Anuruddha, when you can't pin down the Tathagata as a truth or reality, even in the present life, is it proper for you to declare, friends, the Tathagata, the supreme man, the superlative man, attainer of the superlative attainment, being described is described other than with these four positions? The Tathagata exists after death, does not exist after death, both does and does not exist after death, neither exists nor does not exist after death. No, Lord. Very good, Anuruddha. Very good. Both formerly and now, it is only stress that I describe and the cessation of stress. So, the discourses are archaic, fabricated many centuries ago, millennia ago, and they're repetitive because for centuries, up to the time of the Buddha, they were passed on from one, you know, teacher to a student, generations by word of mouth. So they were memorized, and they're still chanted, memorized and chanted even today. So I'm going to be talking about how these different comments, positions, if you will, conceptual positions, deconstruct the notion of there being an enduring self, one that is separated from, autonomous in the world. First, the notion of what khanda means. First of all, pancha means five. Khanda means an aggregation, cohesive cluster of different elements. Upadana is clinging or attachment. When we think of an aggregate, the most obvious example is concrete. You know, you have gravel, you have sand, you have cement, you have water. All by themselves, they don't function in a particular way, it's useful. Aggregate them in the right proportions and they bond chemically and makes a really firm substance, durable. So that's what this notion of the aggregates is. It's a bonding of different functions or characteristics. What bonds them? Upadana, clinging or attachment. And I'll be talking more about that later on in the discussion tonight. But this notion of bonding involves craving and clinging. Upadana is clinging. And another term is tanha, which is craving. translation of tanha is an unquenchable thirst. An alternate translation of upadana is fuel or sustenance. So all of these different functions of a personality are co-occurring, interacting, mutually influential. Next week, I'm going to talk about a really core concept in Buddhism. It's called paticca samuppada, which is translated as dependent origination. The Buddha said that if you understand dependent origination, if you not just conceptually understand it, but you really see it, experience it, that is what will bring liberation from dukkha. So this binding together of these different characteristics is what creates self. And the practice of vipassana, insight, is meant to deconstruct this misunderstanding, deconstruct this notion of there being a self. So the five aggregates, which I mentioned in the guided contemplation that preceded this talk, which that will be posted along with this talk and the notes that I'm referring to, probably tomorrow on the website. The five aggregates are form, perception, feeling, conditioning factors, and consciousness. And the quotes, I think they're called fabrications. These terms do not describe things, they are describing processes. It's a process through which stimulation occurs. Light, sound, odor, flavor, sensations in the body. That's form. Perception, feeling, and conditioning factors are functions that basically organize the stimuli in ways that are meaningful. And they're reflected in consciousness. During that guided contemplation, I referred to the consciousness as a mirror. The mirror has no opinion. It simply reflects that which is, you know, the light that is that hits it. That's what consciousness is. Now, I'm going to talk about those more specifically later in the talk. In the notes, I have a couple of graphic illustrations. One of them is on the board here in the meditation hall. And it, you can see that it's constructed as what's called a Venn diagram. Venn diagram is basically two overlapping circles. Actually, there could be more overlapping circles, but in this context, it's two overlapping circles. Those two overlapping circles are consciousness. One of the circles is form. That would be the eyes and seeing, the ears and hearing, and so forth and so on. And that overlaps into another circle. And in the overlapped part, there's perception and feeling. And in the upper part of the upper circle is conditioning factors. Them called chittasikas. There, among those 50 are two that are particularly important, craving and clinging. So that illustrates how this process of creating a self occurs, operates. Feeling and perception are bridging functions. Now, feeling and perception are both mind conditioners as well, in a particular place. Those of you here in the room, if you'll look at the charts on the wall, you'll see there are chitasikas, and feeling and perception are two of them. All on the left. So this is what we're observing, is this kind of dynamic, interactive process. Now, I want to talk about this interactive thing and using another term, which is namarupa. I like using the Buddhist terms, the Pali terms, out of respect for the longevity of this tradition, but also because I think it's useful to understand what they meant back in those days and how that might be related to what we understand today. So nama rupa, word nama means name, and that's basically feelings, perceptions, and mind conditioners in consciousness. And rupa is form. So they are always interacting. We cannot understand sensations without involving feeling, perception, and fabrications, mind conditioners, in as reflected in consciousness. It just can't happen. When we pay attention to the sensation of breathing, there's a feeling there, it's neutral. There's a perception there, there's an intention to set aside all the other subjective experiences that are cascading through consciousness, and primarily focus on changing sensations as you breathe in and breathe out. So that is perception. So perception does. It's how it operates in the brain. Now, the other thing that's interesting about mindfulness of breathing, it does not require any kind of story. There's still a notion of an observing self, a witnessing self, but it's not elaborated. It doesn't spin off into the kinds of narratives that we experience routinely. I call it the selfing story, these narratives. There's no selfing story required with the sensation of breathing. You're just presently aware, which is very, very useful in the process of liberation from distress and confusion. So understanding what we're experiencing as this blending of an embodied experience and a mind that is making a self, making meaning out of that, is a very important part of this. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the talk that we've been reviewing the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And this particular concept, the five aggregates, are listed in the fourth foundation. So I'm going to read off the quote that refers to that. Furthermore, the monk remains focused on mental qualities in and of themselves with reference to the five clinging aggregates. And how does he remain focused on mental qualities in and of themselves with reference to the five clinging aggregates? There is the case where a monk discerns such as form, such its origination, such as disappearance, such as feeling, such as perception, such as fabrication, such as consciousness, such its origination, such its disappearance. In this way, he remains focused internally on mental qualities in and of themselves, or externally on mental qualities in and of themselves, or both internally and externally on mental qualities in and of themselves, or he remains focused on the phenomenon of origination with regard to mental qualities, on the phenomenon of passing away with regard to mental qualities, or on the phenomenon of origination and passing away with regard to mental qualities, or his mindfulness that there are mental qualities is maintained to the extent of knowledge and remembrance. And he remains independent, unsustained by, not clinging to anything in the world. This is how a monk remains focused on mental qualities in and of themselves with reference to the five clinging aggregates. Now, that second body of the quote, in this way, he remains focused internally on mental qualities. That's called the refrain, and it's repeated throughout the four foundations. And there are specific meanings associated with the terms in here. I talked about them weeks ago when I first started talking about the conceptual structure of the four foundations of mindfulness. But the thing that I want to point out is that being focused on the phenomenon of origination and of passing away, or just being aware of there are mental qualities. What that does is it starts to differentiate the notion that there is an enduring autonomous self. It starts to deconstruct that, which is what this practice is all about. Now, this is not nihilistic. You know, one of the criticisms of Buddhism is that it's very nihilistic. It's meaningless. You know, there's no self. That's not what it means. What it means is that the sense of self comes about as a result of the interaction between the what we call the external world, rupa, and the internal processes that are interpreting and responding to the external world, nama. That's what this is about. Doesn't mean that there is no personality. What it does is it creates a heightened awareness that personality is a creative process, and that we can manage that process. In the same way that an athlete can manage a very complex routine of behaviors, basketball player or a gymnast or a musician, you know, there are all these different behaviors that have to be put together in a certain kind of sequence, a craft. Well, this is about the craft of selfing. So it doesn't mean that you're getting rid of the self. It means that there's a different fundamental understanding of a process through which experience is made meaningful. Right? This guy we call the Buddha, the Tathagata, master of suchness, experienced the ultimate potential of this process when he was 35. And continued to teach people about this for another 40 or 45 years. Right? That's pretty remarkable. So it wasn't as though the guy became dysfunctional because he deconstructed the notion of himself. He perhaps became even more functional because there was no need to defend or gratify the ego. Just doing the right thing. So that's what this process is about. Now, talk a bit about karma. Karma is basically how our personal history influences how we create a contemporary sense of being. Language that we learn, how we are conditioned by gender, by color of our skin, or by nationality, or ethnicity. All of those are influences that dynamically shape a sense of value, of identity, and so forth and so on, that we either want to gratify, be appreciated for, valued for, or defend against. Well, what this is doing is changing that whole structure, the way this process of selfing occurs, and organizes it around the principles of clarity, kindness, compassion, and generosity. The ability to be tolerant of ambiguity, right? To be able to work with the uncertainty and variety of life experiences more and more effectively without doing harm to self or others. That's what this system is about. Okay. This fabrication has been analyzed by contemporary neuroscience. I'm very big on neuroscience. Those of you sat with me know this is true. And I think that a lot of contemporary neuroscientific research validates what Buddhists have been talking about for a millennium. We know now that different parts of the brain have different functions. We have part of the brain that functions regarding language, another part that functions regarding visual processing, another part for auditory processing, emotional processing, so forth and so on. All of these are very interactive and aggregate these functions into a sense of self, sense of subjective experience. This process we know now from research of coming together, of aggregating these different functions, occurs multiple times a second. The simile that I've used many times, and others as well, is a motion picture film. You know, it's a long strip. Don't use them anymore. It's now computers, but used to be a long celluloid strip with still images on it, right? And they all looked pretty much the same unless you got to what's called an editing cut, which it might change abruptly to another series of still images. But you put that strip through what we call a projector, the right speed, the right focus, the right lighting. These different still images blend together through a process that's called binding, neural binding. They blend together and create the illusion of somebody moving around on the screen. Well, that's how our process of selfing occurs. Multiple times a second, particular aggregation of these different functions kind of pops up in awareness and dissolves, and another one pops up multiple times a second and gets blended. Now, Buddhism has known this for a very, very long time. There's a level of consciousness in Theravada Buddhist psychology. It's called arising and passing away. I have had that experience at one point in one retreat. So I know that it's valid. But what it amounts to is that there's a flickering effect, sort of like being in a room with a strobe light. You know, you move your arm and it seems like there are different arms at different positions moving through the your line of sight. That's because the strobe is bouncing on and off multiple times a second. Well, you can have that direct subjective awareness of a self, and then another self, and then another self, and another self. That direct awareness can be quite shocking. When I had the experience, it frightened me. It's sort of like trying to walk on ice and not being able to get traction. In this context, there was the experience of all these different self states, but they weren't sticking together. They weren't adhering like they normally do. And that's the deconstruction of the sense of an enduring autonomous self. So modern neuroscience actually can analyze this, but the whole mystery of what consciousness is cannot be resolved in that regard. Consciousness is this process of awareness that we're all experiencing, but it's still a bit of a mystery. Having said that, now I want to talk about more particularly each one of these aggregates. First one's called Rupakanda. And that's basically, it's a repetition of the first of the four foundations of mindfulness, Kaya Nupassana, mindfulness of the body. Now, I use the word Kanda to describe an aggregate, but Kaya also describes, in a sense, it's sort of like synonymous. It means a body. Like if you have a group of people that we call a musical band marching around football field, that group interacting in a particular pattern, that's a kaya. So kaya nupassana basically means being mindful of how physicality, the sensational world that we live in, kind of operates. When we're seeing things, there are also auditory processes going on at the same time, and kinesthetic processes, and perhaps olfactory and gustatory processes, all of them going on all at the same time. So that's what Rupakanda is. So we want to be able to realize on a conceptual level that when we are experiencing being alive, being embodied, all these different functions are co-operating and are mutually influencing. What I mean by that is when light hits the eye, it stimulates certain processes. At the same time, sounds that might be associated with what's generating the light that's hitting the eye are also being processed. And those two, when combined, create a perception and an image in the mind. That's a bird, and the bird is singing. So this is another way to understand Rupakanda. This understanding requires feeling, perception, mental fabrication, reflected in consciousness. So that's what we're talking about with the first of the five aggregates. Second one is Vedanakanda. Well, Vedana is feeling. Vedanakanda. Vedana is typically translated as feeling. It's the second foundation of the four foundations of mindfulness. When we use the word feeling in English, it can be a bit confusing. What we're really talking about, there's another contemporary psychological term that's, I think, works better. It's affect, A-F-F-E-C-T. Affect is an impulsive reactivity to a stimulus. Could be visual, could be auditory, et cetera, et cetera. It also could be cognitive. It could be an affective response to a thought or a mood. When we're talking about Vedana and affect, if there's a pleasant feeling tone, it's called affect approach. If it's an unpleasant feeling tone, affect avoidance. Then if there's a neutral feeling tone, it's just, I don't even know if you can use the word affect, because the characteristic of an affect is that it has to have some kind of reactivity associated with it. Physiological reactivity. It stimulates certain neural and metabolic processes in the body. You know, the startle effect. You know, something, a sound, a sudden loud sound occurs, and it creates a metabolic response. There's a startle effect. That's fundamental. It's biological. It's organic. Every creature will experience that kind of response. What we're talking about, though, with this practice is being able to observe with mindfulness the Vedana of any given moment. By the way, Vedana, feeling, is one of those, it's the second of the list on the Chittasikas, right? Every moment of subjective experience has a feeling tone, and every moment has a perceptual quality. When we have this instinctive response set, and the mind is not well trained, there's an impulsive reactivity. You want to scratch the itch. And one of the things I suggested, I don't know if I did this in the guided contemplation or not, but you notice the feeling tone of that sensation. It's unpleasant, but you ride it out. You just let it be what it is, understanding it as a phenomenon. There are certain nerve endings somewhere in your body that are hyperactive and sending a signal to the brain. Probably it's instinctual because it could have been, you know, poison ivy or an insect bite, something like that. But generally, no, it's just these nerve endings firing off for some reason. But there's a feeling of compulsion. You need to scratch the itch. Now that, when you learn how to mindfully observe the urgent feeling that's unpleasant in a way that is non-reactive, that puts it in the category of being a phenomenon, not a threat, and watch it change, watch it play out. That's very beneficial because the same neurological processes in your brain that are involved in scratching an itch also might be involved in some behavior that's probably not in your best interest, right? In psychology, we call this kind of discipline impulse control training. People who are trying to recover from addictions, they really want to understand the urgency of craving and not act on it. So you have to desensitize to the urgency. So that's what we're practicing with this mindfulness of feelings, is to address the aggregate of feeling. The other thing it's important to understand about Vedana, I mentioned that it can be a feeling that is physical, also be a feeling that is mental or cognitive. So if someone says something that you interpret as insulting, there's an unpleasant feeling. Now, the feeling is not in the sound. It's just sound. You know, it's what the mind makes of it that is problematic through craving and clinging. So we want to observe that urgent reactivity in a way that desensitizes the impulse to act on it. So that when you are practicing mindfulness of breathing meditation and the mind jumps track to, I don't know, worrying about something, you are mindful of the urgency, the demand of the storyline that demands attention, kind of enchantment. Observe the feeling. You can experience it in your body, in your emotions, kind of magnetism. But because you practice not giving into the urge to scratch the itch, because the behavioral response has that same kind of magnetism, you learn how to desensitize to the urge to react to the insult, right? That's very, very helpful. So during the contemplation, or guided contemplation, I mentioned that mindfulness of feelings is a very key part of this. I mentioned previously paticca samuppada, which I'm going to talk about at length next week, dependent origination. The key element for, and dependent origination is about how to change karma, how to change how you respond to current circumstances, depends on mindfulness of feeling, discipline about being aware of feelings in a non-reactive way. So that's Vedana Khanda. The next one is Sanya Khanda. Sanya is perception. It's what separates out a particular part of the cascade of ongoing stimulation from all the others. You practice mindfulness of breathing, you're intentionally disregarding sensations other than the embodied experience of breathing in and breathing out. Whenever we are experiencing any phenomena, there's this perceptual process that goes on multiple times a second. Now, you can have several of them that are strung together. The perception is pretty continuous. But when that's associated with the feeling and the storyline, that's what creates the problems. That's what blends all the different cells on the film strip together, right? So you want to do is make the mind agile enough and accurate enough in observing the changing nature of perceptions so that you no longer make a link between a feeling and a perception, which are pretty much co-occurring, and the selfing story. Now, just to throw a bit more neurology into it, when we're talking about feelings, there's a part of the brain called the amygdala. It functions very closely with another part of the brain that's right next to it called the hippocampus. The amygdala is mostly involved with feeling or affect. The hippocampus is mostly involved with perception. Those two are coordinated, mutually influential, and are associating what's happening right now with prior experience. Making, you know, what prior experience is kind of imposed, superimposed on what's happening right now, and creating a sense of self in this regard. Now, when we're trying to understand Sanya, it's important to realize that exclusionary process. The meaning of Sanya back in the day, one of the similes that the Buddha used, was a carpenter. Now, if you have a particular area that you want to cover with a piece of wood, you take a tape measure and you measure the dimensions of a hole. Then you go to a piece of wood and you very carefully measure out those dimensions and draw lines, and you cut along those lines and you separate that piece of wood from the larger piece of wood, and you fit it into that gap. That's what Sanya meant back in the day. You can see how that's relevant to what we're talking about here in terms of how the mind imposes a self and a meaning on an event that is otherwise not organized. Now, I'm going to be talking more about this next week with the paticca samuppada concept. But what we're talking about in terms of Sanya is the fundamental misperception that this flux of changing stimuli and responses, this nama rupa, somehow or other is in a solid self, an enduring self that operates outside of the laws of nature, somehow separated out, which is not possible. It's impossible. We are absolutely immersed in the world. And affects us, we affect it. So we want to change the perception that there's an autonomous, enduring self to more of what's called an interdependent experience, a way of, rather than fighting with experience, kind of dancing with experience. The next aggregate is sankhara, sankhara khanda. Sankhara is a very complex term. Sankhara is synonymous with karma. It's also synonymous with chittasika. It can have two different ways you can understand it. One of them is in the form of sort of like a noun, which would be a memory. The other would be in the form of a verb, which is sort of like an enactment based on a memory. So when we talk about karma as a memory, there's a particular term for that, vipaka. And vipaka basically means the potential for understanding or action. When you act on a particular karmic or sankhara influence, you create a self relative to that. That goes back into storage. When it goes back into storage, it's vipaka. When it comes back out of storage because you're acting on it, then it's karma or sankhara. Mentioned earlier that there are 50 chittasikas. Actually, there are 52 if you count feeling and perception. They're just different categories of how a moment of self-organization is shaped. They're subdivided into wholesome, universal categories that can either be wholesome or unwholesome categories, or wholesome categories. That's what we're talking about with the notion of sankhara, is how our personal history or our cultural history influences how we see ourselves in the world, how we see the world and its functions, and act on that. Now, I'm going back to the notion about scratching the itch. One of the things that's important for us to do is to adapt to changing circumstances, to be able to do that. This is a theme that I have hammered away at all year. We are emerging from a pandemic, or we are entering into a period of climate crisis. Certainly, sociopolitical upheaval is occurring. All of these things are going to put a lot of pressure on us. The extent to which we are caught up in the notion that there's an enduring autonomous self, we're going to suffer. There's going to be a lot of distress and confusion, right? But the more we can investigate how we have been conditioned as Americans, as consumers, as males, females, Democrats, Republicans, just figure out all these different categories. The more we can understand them as conditions, not demands, the more we can be flexible and adaptive in how we relate to the world, because it's going to change. It is changing. So we have to learn how to change in ways that are adaptive, individually, and hopefully on a larger scale culturally. That's what we're supposed to be doing. It's one of the, hopefully one of the blessings of democracy, is that we can adapt. We'll see. So that's what sankhara is. It's conditions, the selfing story. And what we want to do is understand how that conditioning operates and be able to modify it in ways that promote kindness, compassion, clarity, and generosity, and the ability to work with ambiguity. Next one, vijnana khanda. That's the consciousness part. Now, vijnana is another complicated term. Modern neuroscience talks about what's called the soft problem of consciousness and the hard problem of consciousness. The soft problem of consciousness I already described. We know now where in the brain visual processes are operating. We know that with some degree of precision. That's the soft problem of consciousness. How it all comes together, that's the hard problem of consciousness. Been a lot of research on that. Reason why it's a hard problem, we have technology to analyze how the neural patterns are operating, but we don't have technology that can understand how it all comes together. But the brilliance of Buddhism, particularly the notion of what are called the seven awakening factors, which are also in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which I'll begin talking about in a few weeks, are actually very, very important in terms of understanding consciousness, how consciousness operates, and how to work with consciousness. If you want more understanding about consciousness from the Buddhist psychology perspective, get the notes that I'm going to be posting. I don't want to take the time to dive into that right now. What I do want to say, though, is that about consciousness, I mentioned about how the different cells in a film strip blend together. It's called the eidetic effect. Another way to understand it is if you look at a candle flame for a minute or so and close your eyes, there's a contradictory image that corresponds to the outline of the candle flame in your mind's eye. It's what we call the eidetic effect. What it means is that the visual processing neurons in the back of your brain have become highly activated and they keep firing off for a period of time. And then the firing off diminishes and disorganizes. That process is going on all the time. It's what cognition is. That's what the experience of consciousness is this blending of one moment and the next moment and the next moment. Because there's a slight after effect from one moment of neural aggregation to the next, slight afterglow. Right. In modern psychology, it's called a binding moment of consciousness. Actually, there are correlates to that in classic Buddhist psychology as well. The eidetic effect. That's what consciousness is subjectively. And when I talked about having this experience of the arising and passing away of moments of self-aggregation, that was an experience of the unbinding of that. That's part of what helps deconstruct the notion that there's an enduring autonomous self. It's not, it has benefit in terms of making the experience of selfing more adaptive, more flexible, because I can learn how to channel that the flow of energy in creating the self more skillfully, more ethically, in terms of what's called right speech, right action, and right livelihood from a Buddhist perspective. Okay, so that's what I have to say. One more thing. I started to talk about this before, that the Buddha apparently was able to completely disintegrate the notion that there's an enduring autonomous self through repeated experiences of what's called nirvana, the unconditioned. This did not mean that he became dysfunctional. He perhaps became more functional in the context of that culture. What we want to be able to do with this process is to develop a more and more sophisticated understanding of how these aggregates interact so that we are less distressed and confused because of all these conflicting values that we're conditioned by. If a good citizen is defined by where you were raised. And we have a lot of conflict now about what it means to be a good citizen or a good consumer, right? Overconsumption is destroying the ecology of the planet. We have to change that. So this process of deconstructing the personality, if you will, hopefully will enable us to be more successful in this adaptation. Doesn't mean that you have to go to become an arhat or a Buddha. Doesn't mean that at all. It just means to be a more functional human being. That's the story of my life. I've been doing this for over half my life, and my life is much, much better place than it would have been had I not begun with this. So that's what I keep holding out to people. This is about experiencing a higher quality of life and being a better citizen of the planet. Okay, so those are my comments. Now we have the opportunity for people to ask questions or add your own comments or insight. Anybody? Either in the room here or in the Zoom meeting.
I think your ability to simplify some of those subjects is fascinating.
Could you speak a little louder so it gets recorded? People can hear what you're saying.
Yeah, I think your ability to simplify some of those complex abstract concepts is pretty interesting, pretty amazing. The picture of what you were talking about, those concepts aren't really easy to explain in a way that you can digest them. So appreciate that.
Thank you, and I hope that it inspires you to consider exploring the craft of selfing through this modality. I hope that you will align with your sister.
Daughter.
You really look young.
I'm better in the soul.
Yes. Okay. All right. Well, anyway, thank you for that. And I hope it's helpful. Other questions or comments? Yes, sir.
It's interesting. I'm like Peter, a long-term meditator, but it's always interesting to hear you talk. And as we've all come back together, I'd like to watch you light up because you like to talk, and it's very helpful. And but I just want to say that it's like a physiology class that you that Voodoo tapped into 2,500 years ago. That, I mean, the selfing story, for example, it's all the timing is there anyway, whether you say any words or not. When you understand that you think in words, then you understand a little bit about how these processes are going on. For example, persistence of vision that you described several ways is like the motion picture screen. Every time 1/24th of a piece of film goes by, the light goes into you. It takes about a 30th of a second for it to dissolve, and then the next frame comes. But this is what your body was designed to do with all of your senses. You're hearing, you're smelling, you're seeing, and all these processes are going on. And so when you sit, you get to be still, and you kind of understand how these processes work and how you think in words. And if you cannot react, and if you can just go back to breath, you can. stopped yourself from hurting yourself with your thoughts or getting angry. And it's just amazing to me how the mind will trick you if it can, because it will have a pattern on the way you think. And that when you sit and do something not thinking, like watch the breath, you can tune it down. And it just amazes me how quickly the mind will move in to try to stop you, prevent you, and it never fails. And then I get upset, but here I am hearing Peter talk again, and I didn't remember that again. So I just have to share all that.
Well, you know, part of the quote said to be mindful for remembrance, and it means to remember to investigate your experience with that same kind of detachment and engaged interest. So other questions or comments?
I was during the meditation, the guided meditation tonight, I was really interested in how my mind was going in all different directions, and I would bring it back as I noticed that it was in some kind of a story, some thoughts that were going on, and then I would come back and it would go off again, and I would come back, and I was feeling neutral about the whole process because it just kept on moving away, noticing it, bringing it back. And for whatever reason, it was pretty interesting tonight. And I just wanted to mention that I had discovered a podcast, which many of you know about, 10% Happier, Dan Harris. I think it's Dan Harris.
Yeah.
He just had, it's a recent podcast with Shyla Catherine on being distracted. And she goes into a great deal of depth in the podcast for those of you who are interested. And many of the Sangha members know Shyla Catherine. And I thought it was very, very good, because she builds from she went into a great deal of detail. So you can easily locate it if you're interested.
Well, also, Shyla is going to be leading a retreat here at the San Pedro Center in February, next February, and she'll probably be elaborating on those skill sets as well. She's actually written a book about overcoming distraction.
And what was interesting, Peter, was that Dan Harris was asking her about how to deal with distraction. And it was kind of interesting because he hadn't considered that this is something that happens to, it sounded like he was surprised that it happens no matter how long you've been meditating or how, you know, what the circumstances is. And there was a really good question that he had that I thought was really beneficial to hear her talk about. She said, oh yeah, my mind, you know, it happens all the time. It happens, you know, when you're meditating, when you're not meditating, and how you shift your thinking, and how you, if there's something that's going on in the mind that's distracting, you just notice it and then change your thinking. I mean, I'm paraphrasing it. You all can hear it on your own, but I thought it was worth listening to. So
yeah, there's a benefit to stilling the mind. But fundamentally, what this is about is understanding how the mind creates a self from a different perspective that is not ego defensive or ego gratifying, so that events arise and pass away. Just like in that quote, you notice the arising and passing away of phenomena internally, externally, both internally and externally. So the external part would be about changing sounds in the environment. The internal part would be about the mind's either increasing or decreasing attention to the changing sound. So this is a very useful protocol for investigating these processes in a way that does not require emptying the mind, just a different perception of how the mind operates. Very important. Joy, and then we have to end the meeting for tonight.
I just look at my meditation from years ago on meditation now. I'm talking about the in-breath and the out-breath, and it's like, did the cat throw up the hairball of the in-breath or the out-breath?
Yes.
And moving on.
Yes. Okay, so as I mentioned before, the topic for next week's review will be dependent origination. And I will be discussing it from a contemporary perspective, as well as the classic one. It's our custom at the end of each sitting for us to, each meeting, for us to sit together quietly for a few seconds. So let's do that. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well. I hope that we're all reasonably safe and happy until the next time we have a chance to meet.